The Guardian.
Support for this podcast comes from Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes creating a professional website for your business, personal brand, or portfolio so easy, it's newsworthy. Go to squarespace.com and use the offer Guardian to get 10% off.
Welcome to the Edinburgh Books Podcast. I'm just out of a session titled Conflict and the Conflicted with today's two guests. It's a great title for a couple of books which both feature the Second World War but don't do so in any simple way. Gerard Woodward's Vanishing is the story of a hapless artist who finds himself devising camouflage for the Allied army in the African desert. Adam Fool's In the Wolf's Mouth is set in Sicily as the Allied troops push up into Italy. They're both full of conflicted characters. Gerard, would you start by introducing us to the central character of your novel, Kenneth Brill?
Well, Kenneth Brill is, as you say, a sort of conflicted character. He grew up in the village of Heathrow before it was an airport, went to art school, became an artist, and ended up in the camouflage corps. But all through the novel, he's sort of trying to establish his identity, and he's very confused about himself and how he sees himself and how others see him.
So read us a little bit from the opening of the novel.
He came into my cell this morning. No knock, no announcement, just the approaching beat of nailed boots on a concrete floor, the oiled fuss of several keys in several locks, then the door swinging open, and Davis entering with a casual offhand saunter that contrasted with the military stiffness of the armed guards who had preceded him. I was still in bed at this point, even though it was several hours after breakfast, and out of a sort of panic, I decided to feign sleep and lay there with my face half turned into the pillow, allowing a little dribble of saliva to roll off my lolling tongue. Lieutenant Brill, he said, in quietly amused officer tones, making it obvious that he recognised my fakery. Your snoring is most convincing, but I could see that your eye was open as I entered the room. The problem of pretending to be asleep is having to carry through the whole charade of waking up, which is somewhat harder to fake. How should one play it? The sudden startled bolt into the vertical, or the long slow dredging of the self from the depths of dreamlessness? I went for the slower option, gradually lifting my head from the pillow, sucking in my remaining spit and blinking in the glare of Davis's uniform. He was in full officer dress, Sam Brown, brassoed buttons, a strip of medals, pips. He held his peaked cap beneath his left arm, along with a cardboard folder of documents. He smelt of snuffed candles. So sorry if I've disturbed your sleep, but I thought you would be up and about by now. I would call back later, but I'm rather rushed. Would you mind getting up and dressed so that we can talk properly? I looked round for my clothes. I'd rather carelessly left them in a heap on the floor by the bottom of the bed. I had nothing on beneath my blanket. It had been a stiflingly hot night. Davis followed my gaze and recognised my concern. Wordlessly, I hinted that he might do me the favour of picking up my clothes and passing them to me. He in turn gestured for one of the guards to do the deed, and the fellow promptly shouldered his Tommy gun and bent down to pick up my things, handling them with an arm's length distaste and depositing them on my bed. Seeming to think that this was sufficient, all three stood in a row and watched me like an audience at a late-night cabaret. "Am I allowed no privacy?" I said. Davis smiled. After all these years in the army, you expect privacy. He indicated with a wave of the fingertips that the guards could wait outside, and when they had gone, he turned halfway, so that he was facing the little window high in the wall, which revealed nothing but sky. I struggled to dress while concealed beneath my blanket. Davis spoke without looking at me. This obstinate modesty of yours is rather touching. It's not something I would have expected of you, not with your record. I don't know what you mean. Davis went over to the small, bare table and placed his folder there. Though, on the other hand, perhaps your work in the camouflage corps has given you an instinctive urge for concealment. I imagine to be a successful camoufleur, one must have a predilection for privacy, to be obsessive about it even. It seems to go against the natural instincts of display and advertisement, the urge to announce one's existence to the world. Did you ever struggle with that contradiction? By now I had pulled on my trousers and the dirty pullover that was too hot for the room, they would supply me with nothing else. Davis's remarks about concealment had put me in half in mind of presenting my naked self to him, dropping the blanket and standing to attention by my bed, everything on display. How would he have liked that, I wondered. The only contradiction I've struggled with is that of a soldier who has served his country with distinction in one of the cruelest theatres of war, and now finds himself incarcerated in a dirty little cell for no good reason at all. That's not just a contradiction, that's a damned affront, an insult.
There are so many little clues in that scene. He has a thing about nudity, doesn't he? And he's always getting into trouble, and he's in one hell of a mess at this point.
Yes, I mean, I suppose the conflict in him comes about through, or is expressed through, a sense of unease about the body. One of the first things that happens in the novel is that he gets involved with these childhood games with his best friend, Marcus Boone, which is a sort of sexual, it seems like a sexual game, but it's not really. They sort of strip their clothes off and they're sort of excited by being naked, but not sexually. They're sort of excited by the transgression and the misbehaviour and the doing something wrong, rather than the sexuality of it, or so it seems. Kenneth plays a horrible prank on Marcus when he steals his clothes when they do this game in school, in the toilets, and he's sort of left totally vulnerable with nowhere to go. And it sort of haunts him through the rest of the novel, in a way. When he goes to art school, sees a naked man in the life drawing studio, he sort of has a terrible sort of physical funny turn and can't quite understand why. You know, it's all entwined with his own sexuality and his feelings about men and women.
He's gay, which is one of his problems, isn't he? But he probably doesn't even quite know it. He's asexual through a lot of the novel.
You could say he's suppressing it, or he's denying it, or you could say he just doesn't realise it. It's probably a combination of those things. He tries to deal with it in various ways, through his friendships with men and women, and through his attempt to resolve it through marriage, which doesn't really work. But yes, I mean, this is something that really fuels the conflict in the novel.
Let's move to you now, Adam. You have three main characters. Well, actually, you have four if you count the baddie, but I'm rather curious. I only count the goodies as central characters. I'm very interested to know which of the four you're going to focus on in your reading.
I'm going to read a little bit that talks about a character called Ray Marfione, who's an Italian-American infantryman. He's come from Little Italy in New York, a very kind of exclusively immigrant world, a tight little world. The army really introduces him to the rest of America in a way that's very eye-opening to him. And there's a particular focus in this passage on his impressions of and growing affection for a Midwesterner called George, who's a kind of person he hasn't really encountered before, and who becomes very emotionally important to him through the course of the events of the novel. From his assumed position of invisibility, Ray looked out at the other men and found them fascinating. They came from all over, from worlds Ray had never seen. Some of them talked with him, and Ray replied as best he could. But there was something different about George. When George noticed him and spoke to him, Ray didn't feel frightened. He was the opposite of his brother, the opposite of a bully. George was tall, mellow, a decent Midwesterner, the kind of American they put in propaganda films. He had a round-cheeked face, eyelids that hung at a slight diagonal down to the outer edges of his eyes, and a small mouth. His neat ears, exposed by his crew cut, were sometimes comical, sometimes sad. Gentle and unassuming, his easy way with friendly gestures had a powerful effect on Ray. The first time Ray really noticed this was at the end of an assault course. He crossed the line, nauseous with effort. His lungs were a tight, burning thickness that he couldn't get air into. He bent double and drooled onto the ground. When he straightened up again, George winked at him. Nice day for a stroll. Nothing clever or out of the ordinary, just a little humour. When they played cards together, the slow courtesy of George's manners made Ray think of the real America that he came from, evenings spent talking softly and watching the sunset from rural porches. It was nice to get a feel of that. Ray thought that if you put George in a cowboy picture, he would be the store owner who becomes the sheriff when the sheriff is shot, a man who just knows what is right and sticks to that.
Again, a really revealing passage. Ray is obsessed with a sort of American dream, but it's a very male version. Both of these are very very masculine novels, aren't they?
I guess that's true. I mean, I think I wanted to kind of chew at masculinity a bit and kind of interrogate what that what that means. And one of the things that I got interested in was how expressive men in a military context are towards each other and how kind of openly emotional they are, which is sort of somehow kind of licensed by those circumstances in a way that isn't often or kind of similarly the case in civilian society. So the intense bond between Ray and George, particularly for Ray, is an important part of that, and it's kind of getting deeper into a kind of military masculinity sort of beyond the cliches. But you know, one of the cliches that then proves to be true is that ultimately people are fighting for the person next to them, and that the sort of horizontal bond between fellow soldiers is incredibly intense. You know, it's the bond of, and it's very deep in our literature and our culture, it's the bond of Achilles and Patroclus. And it was that very same deep kind of emotional fusion was experienced by many soldiers, and you know, and is being experienced today.
You have very different sorts of masculinities that are represented by your different characters. So you've got Ray on the one hand and his intense comradeship. You've got Will, who's an English officer who wants to rule the world. He wants to run things. He wants to make a difference and be the father who sort of makes everything work. And then you've got these Sicilian thugs, basically, whose masculinity is about being, you know, actually killing somebody who gets in your way.
Yeah, I guess, that's true. I mean, I don't know that I thought of them as thugs. I mean, there is one particular character who is a mafioso, who's a significant character. But it's very interesting, and one of the things I had to kind of traverse early on in my thinking about the book and my research for it was dealing with a group of people whose sense of virtue is really social, and is about fulfilling certain kind of social forms and obligations, and is about, there's this concept in Italian of bella figura, of, you know, appearing, you know, to be the right kind of person, and whose inner life is actually very shared and is very sort of conversational and communal. So in a way, within the terms of the society that he lives and the vows that he's sworn and the kinds of expectations that other people have of him, Ciro Albanese, my kind of main mafioso character, does exactly what he should do.
So this novel is partly about, it prefigures the growth of the mafia, international mafia, in that Sicily has exported its mafiosi who've been running away from fascism into America, and they come back with the conquering forces.
They do, and with new skills and with a new sense of kind of international possibilities for how their businesses might turn out beyond the end of the war. So yes, it's really, that was in a way the subject that most kind of pulled me into wanting to write this novel, was this very interesting moment where the mafia, which had been very successfully curtailed by fascism, returns and metastasizes and gets a grip on Sicily again, which has not as yet, unfortunately, been fully loosened.
So one could almost say you're conflicted slightly about fascism, about the imprint of fascism on Sicily.
We'll study on. But I would go, it's obviously historically the case that fascism did jail mafiosi, they laid siege to town of Ganji, and they drove many mafiosi into exile. I mean, any state could have done it, any strong state. Mafiosi came to exist really in the late 18th century and early into the 19th century in the gap, you know, in the way that banditry always does, in the gaps, and the way that organized crime does, and sort of alternative social systems of tribute and protection do, in societies where the state is not strong enough, where the state isn't present enough. And eventually fascism arrived, and with a super kind of muscly state, and boxed them up for a while. But and when they were gone, they all flowed back in again.
The Guardian.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace. When you need to know what's in the news, you turn to The Guardian. When you want to create something newsworthy, you turn to Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes it easy to create your own professional website for your small business, online store, professional portfolio, or blog. Getting started takes only seconds. Just go to squarespace.com, and to support this podcast, use the offer code GUARDIAN to take 10% off.
I'm interested in the fact that both of these novels focus on Italy rather than on Germany, which is the obvious theatre of war. Gerard, tell us about how Italy appears in your novel.
Well, when Kenneth goes to North Africa as part of the Allied campaign against the Axis powers, it's the Italian occupation of Libya that is the main focus of the conflict at that time. So it wasn't my intention in writing the novel to write about Italy in the war, but nevertheless the sort of trajectory that that Kenneth's journey through the war takes made it necessary to write about it. And I became interested in it as the more I wrote about it and the more I researched it. So Samarco, who's Kenneth Bill's tutor and sort of lover and best friend, is half Italian and has obvious sympathies with Italian fascism and futurist painting and so on. There are interesting parallels between what was going on in Kenneth's home village of Heathrow, where he grew up before the airport was built, obviously, and what he sees in North Africa with the retreating Italian occupation, and he sees the gardens of the settlers there. It sort of brought home to me in some ways there are sort of differences between Italian, German and British fascism. They all had their own sort of character in a way, and that was something I was trying to explore in the novel.
There's an awful lot. You mentioned the Heathrow, and it sort of projects forward to the fact that this place that he grew up in is going to be an airport. But there's an awful lot about airplanes in it. I wondered what that's about. He starts off with model planes, then he goes up in an airplane in an escapade with San Marco, then he's always seeing things from the sky. Is that about artistic perspective, or what is it?
It's partly about that, yes. I mean, it's partly about sort of looking down and getting the whole picture and noticing how different the land looks from above, as to how it looks from ground level. And the whole book, in a way, is about how things appear and how they seem, as opposed to how they really are. I mean, all through the novel, Kenneth is doing things that can be seen as morally bad from one viewpoint, but if you look at it from another viewpoint, it's less obvious. I mean, I was very interested in writing about Heathrow because I wanted to write about this place that had vanished, literally, and to explore what was there before it vanished.
A lot of shit.
Yes. Yes, that puts it very precisely. It was a very rich market gardening country, which required a lot of manure to fertilise it. I was interested in the way that this manure, access to good supplies of manure, sort of structured the community, so people who had the best supplies had the more power, because they had the better land. So that takes up quite a lot of the early part of the novel.
Is Kenneth an innocent, or is he a willfully unreliable narrator? And I read the book and came to a slightly different conclusion to a lot of the reviewers, who all see him as devious. But you mentioned in the session that you think of him as innocent and hapless.
I think he's very honest. I mean, I think I was quite surprised by how many people have said this thing about unreliability as a narrator. I mean, he's just seeing things from his point of view. He's not deliberately trying to deceive the reader, other than maybe he's trying to deceive himself or not admitting to certain things. I mean, he writes letters and doesn't post them, letters that explain things and doesn't post them, things like that. He sort of willfully gets himself into trouble. But I don't think he does anything that is devious in that way. I think he is innocent. He doesn't see what's going on around him. He doesn't recognise Samarco's fascism, in the early part of the novel at least. He's not even really sure what fascism is, I think. In the same way that he's not really sure about his own sexuality. So these sort of uncertainties in him are just sort of expressions, I think, that we all feel as human beings, that we're not quite sure what's right and what's wrong. You know, where do we look for guidance in that?
It's always nice to agree with the audience, to agree, find out one agrees with the author. Adam, your perspective, you have these different perspectives, and you're very, very close up to them. So they don't ever really coincide, the perspectives, do they? And that's part of the texture of your novel.
Yes, I think that's right. I mean, they do sort of intertwine in the end, in that they're kind of, their paths cross, but they don't fuse, they don't marry up. And that was partly, I was interested in the individual experience going through these kind of huge, kind of meteorologically turbulent historical events and seeing them all kind of process into the experience of war and be turned around by it and experience its kind of chaotic lack of pattern in a way. My sense of what that was about was my sense of that kind of historical process is that there's this huge amount of event that's kind of at an incredible and uncontrollable and unassimilable speed, and that what history is made of at those times is just the accumulation of these irrevocable things. I had kind of in mind, it's rather kind of abstruse reference, but Walter Benjamin has this famous image of the angel of history that is blown backwards into the future, and the angel wants to go back and fix things, wants to repair the debris of history that it leaves behind, but it can't because its winds are pinned by the storm of kind of oncoming events. And that, my sense of that kind of experience of just one thing after another in the most kind of drastic sense informed the way I wanted those characters to move through the book.
There's some quite horrific war writing in it, and war is actually, it's like it challenges your syntax, so the writing actually breaks up under the sort of impact of every bomb that goes off. How did you manage that, and was that painful to write?
Yes, it was painful, and I wanted to write into the experience of trauma, which is done with one particular character. And as you say, at a key moment, the language sort of splinters and it scatters across the page, and it's absolutely at the limit of what is possibly sayable and thinkable, beyond which is kind of the total chaos of traumatic experience. And it's trauma in the sense that Adam Phillips, I think, gives the word somewhere where he talks about it as precisely that which cannot be narrated. You know, it's where story breaks down, it's where one's sense of everything breaks down. And in The Broken Word, my long poem about the Mau Mau, I'd also written about violence and trauma, but I wanted to write through. I wanted to get inside that experience and see how you kind of reconnect with the world, how you start to build your sense of reality and personhood back. So one of my main characters, his narrative really is just about that, is about getting into a state where his mind is broken, essentially, by what he experiences, and the long and difficult journey to get back to coherence and connection again.
And just one last question. You both work as poets as well as novelists, and I just wondered how you know that something is going to be a novel rather than a poem. I mean, you've written, as you said, about the Mau Mau, which is very, one would think, is a very novelistic subject. How did you know, Adam, that this was a novel, not a poem?
It's probably easier to say why I knew the other thing was a poem, which had to do with the particular way in which I wanted to concentrate and strip down the reader's and the character's experience of those events. So I think it was about, I'm writing in a very kind of cinematic way that was very present in its detail, in kind of close-up. With this, I think it was just the amount of material and the and wanting to be more discursive. I guess that's what it is that, you know, it, as I say, it partly came out of unfinished business from The Broken Word, that I needed to carry on writing through violence and trauma for myself to get to the end of various thoughts about that, and that meant I needed room to exfoliate that subject in which suited prose and the novel more than poetry.
Gerard?
For me, it's a causal question of scale. I think all my novels actually have dealt with long periods of time, and this is probably the longest. You know, it deals with about 40 years, and I just find it very hard to get poems to carry that sort of weight of narrative. You know, I think sometimes about writing a book-length narrative poem, but it just seems, you know, the novel is there as a form that is brilliantly adaptable and can carry these huge stories and is sort of infinitely expandable. So it's a question of the sort of story you want to tell, I think, and the fact that you want to tell a story at all leads you to novel writing, whereas writing poetry is not so much about narrative. It's about sort of moments and experiences and sort of smaller scale things, I think.
Thank you very much. Thank you, both of you. And Vanishing is published by Picador. In the Wolf's Mouth is published by Jonathan Cape.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace. When you need to know what's in the news, you turn to The Guardian. When you want to create something newsworthy, you turn to Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes it easy to create your own professional website for your small business, online store, professional portfolio, or blog. Getting started takes only seconds. Just go to squarespace.com, and to support this podcast, use the offer code Guardian to take 10% off.
For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.